all good things are wild and free. Henry David Thoreau.
So yeah, hell yeah, I want another shot. And again, it's not like, oh, I need that money so bad. Like, I want to do it for that money. Like, no, the experience is phenomenal. You dream about that as a kid, like going out in the middle of nowhere with no tools and hardly anything and like trying to survive. So like the experience is phenomenal. And you learn a lot about yourself, a lot about a neat wild place on the planet. Like, and you meet a bunch of people. So like the experience is phenomenal, but like, I just want to push myself. I want to do better. And I would give anything to have another shot at it. I'd go wherever they said, tropics, Antarctica, I don't care. Time of year, like I'd go.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Whosoever is delighted in solitude is either a wild beast or a god. Aristotle.
Welcome back to Solitude, the companion podcast to the History Channel's epic solo adventure show Alone. I'm Doc, and always I'm joined by my co-host and fan favorite, Jukebox. How's it going, Jukebox?
It's going well. It's a beautiful Monday. Happy to start the week and happy to be back here in our virtual podcast studio. We've got a good episode for our listeners today.
That's right. Big surprise. We are back this week with a special episode that is going to air on both the Solitude and the John Freakin' Muir podcast. It's a special bonus episode for each. We were able to line up an interview with a fan favorite from season 8 of Alone, Coulter Barnes. Welcome to the podcast, Coulter.
Hey, it's good to be here, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Well, hey, we want to thank you for coming on the podcast, and we are very excited to talk to you about the show. It was an incredible season, and you were one of our favorite contestants. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing some of your experiences with us and our listeners.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I like what you guys are doing on here, and I look forward to talking with you guys today.
Okay. Have you listened to any of the episodes on Solitude?
I have. Yep.
Okay. So no, you didn't take any offense at any of our comments, any of our Monday morning quarterbacking going on?
Well, I didn't say that. I enjoy what you're doing. I didn't say, that. But yeah, I like that discussion. I like the analysis. I like, I just like diving a little deeper into it and talking about the show. And so I don't get to do that all the time. So I'm excited to talk with some guys that have really went through the episodes and know.
Yeah. Alone is a fascinating show that really just kind of captivated our attention with dropping people off in the middle of nowhere and giving them their own camera equipment and teaching them how to film themselves. And just watching what happens. It's an incredible concept, and reality TV does not get much better than that.
You know where it came from?
Tell us.
Well, I don't know if you've seen One Man's Wilderness about Dick Frenney. That went to Alaska, I think in 1968. He came in at 51 years old and went into the wilderness and was going to live 1 year with very minimal hand tools. And he ended up staying for 38 years. And so the show, I didn't know this, that show brought me to Alaska. I was in Montana in college when I watched that documentary, and I was going to Alaska. I mean, it was just one more thing to push me up there. And then I was at orientation camp on Alone, like a week before we got dropped, and someone started talking about the One Man's Wilderness. And I was like, oh, that's such a cool show. And they were like, you know, that's what this show Alone came from, right? And I was like, oh my God. Like, I couldn't believe it took me so long to realize that, but it's a fantastic documentary if you haven't seen it.
We'll have to check that out.
I just looked it up now, and I can see how they based the show off of this experience. One Man's Wilderness, an Alaskan Odyssey. There's a book about it too, right? By Sam Keith. Yeah. Based on the journals of Pronicky. Okay, this is great.
You gotta watch it. The journals are fantastic. The documentary is fantastic, but a very similar concept.
Now, Colter, you're up in Anchorage right now, and the Wi-Fi seems to falter a little bit here or there. So if we freeze up, just go ahead and keep talking. It'll come back and it'll catch up. And if there's too big a gap, then, you know, Jukebox and I will fill the gap and we'll just keep going. We'll make it work.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay.
Used to it up here. Might be a little weird on your end.
Hey, Colter, I'm going to throw you a curveball right from the very beginning here because this is going to be a joint episode on both Solitude and my other podcast, the John Freaking Muir Pod. I've got a special gear segment that I do on the John Freaking Muir Pod that you have no idea about. I didn't share this with you. So I'm going to make you think on your feet here.
All right.
Okay. So we've got a special feature we've been doing this season on the John Freaking Muir Pod, and it's called the Must Bring Gear Review, sponsored by the ultralight backpacking gear company, Outdoor Vitals. And here's how it works. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day outdoor adventure, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So Colter, when you're out there out in the middle of nowhere, what is your must bring piece of gear?
Steel Farm Boss 250 chainsaw. Wait, you probably can't pack that. Hold on. Backpacking trip. Let's see. Nothing's going to do more work than a chainsaw. If I was going to, a friend was going to pack with something generic, what piece of equipment would I want?
Yeah, what is the one specific gear you would insist on bringing out there with you?
God. Man, that's a good question. I kind of want to go with in Alaska, you know, and in the backcountry here, I'm going to go with a sleeping bag, like a negative 60. What I took on the show is a negative 60 sleeping bag, synthetic. I think that it could save my life out here. It's cold, it's wet, it's snowy, it's rainy. I'm going to go with the sleeping bag.
Okay. A negative 60. And how cold did it get out there at Chilco Lake in the evening times?
You know, I don't think it ever dropped below zero, but, you know, it was wet, and it was just wet, and it was windy and raining. Like, I know it rained probably half the time we're out there, and so, a synthetic bag, I think, can save your life, and made it a lot more comfortable. I slept like a baby out there because of it, so.
And by sleeping but like a baby, you mean that you woke up every 2 hours crying?
God, dang it. You lobbed that one over the plate for you. All right. Like a stone. That's what I meant to say. I slept like a stone. There we go. But
okay. So let's start off.
Could I take a chainsaw? I mean, why couldn't you?
Your outdoor adventure. If you want to bring a chainsaw, you bring a chainsaw.
Yeah, okay. I thought there were rules to this. Yeah, I'd take a chainsaw in a heartbeat. Ain't no piece of equipment gonna do more work than that. Yeah.
All right. And what brand of chainsaw do you prefer?
Steel.
All right. Jukebox, you want to get us started off with our discussion points here?
Yeah. So I guess, Colter, just a little bit of background information for our listeners about yourself. Sort of, you know, you mentioned you went to college in Montana, and then after, you know, watching this show, you had to move up to Alaska. But what else is there that you would like our listeners and the fans of the show to know about you in terms of growing up, your experience in the outdoors and sort of paying the bills? What's life like for Colter?
Yeah, so I'll give you a kind of a brief rundown of what it's looked like, or at least locations. It hasn't been too many, but I was born in Montana, Cutbank, Montana, and we moved out to Oregon. I have two older brothers. So a family of five moved out to Oregon when I was pretty young, Central Oregon and Madras, Oregon. And we lived there. I went to school there and graduated high school. And we grew up hunting and fishing. And so but it was kind of a different, I'll tell you later, is a little bit different than what I do now, hunting and fishing. But we hunted antelope and mule deer and elk and lots of ducks and geese and pheasants and fished. We trolled for trout and went sturgeon fishing and salmon fishing. And so Then I went out to college at Montana State in Bozeman and continued that, but I got more into fly fishing and bow hunting out there. So started chasing elk with a bow and whitetails and fly fishing, not sinking bait on the bottom, and just kind of learning more, having a lot more, just a richer experience, that it was more about the quest and the trip than about how many things I killed, which is kind of what it was like growing up a little bit. And so then at 22, I moved into the village, village of Kokonok. It's a fly-in only native village in Southwest Alaska, to be a school teacher. And that's when I feel like I got the culmination of this, I don't know culmination, but I got a real in-depth training into what a subsistence-based lifestyle looks like, about living and breathing real close to the land and not doing stuff for sport. I tried not to become a sport fisherman. I tried to transform from a sport fisherman and sport hunter to a subsistence fisherman, subsistence hunter and gatherer. And the people there, I feel like, kind of took me under their wing and helped teach me and invite me and show me show me what that was like. They've been living there for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So that's kind of my story, is from Montana, Oregon, back to Montana, and now in Alaska. And I've been here 15 years. I've always lived off the road system. So only accessible by plane or boat. So most of the towns, 14 of the 15 years have been in towns of less than 150 people. And the smallest one was one. It was just me. So yeah, it's been pretty neat to, you know, take the hunting, fishing, gathering, and have it be a necessity. Like, when you don't have a store in your village, or you're the only person on the island, to be able to, you know, not just do it for fun, but because you kind of need to. And so that changes the game a bit.
Right. I think that's a great story, especially for our listeners who may not know that about you, and, you know, seeing that transition from Oregon to Montana, hunting for sport to hunting and gathering for subsistence. I think that's a large part of how you were able to both mentally and physically handle alone for as long as you did.
Yeah, I think it sure helped. It felt like training. You know, I said I've been training for the show alone for a long time, and it just felt like the lifestyle I was living kind of led, you know, really overlapped and melded with the alone experience pretty well. The isolation, the weather conditions, the hunting, fishing, gathering, every second of the day or every moment you're outside. So yeah, definitely felt pretty prepared.
Now, Coulter, you're in good company. You said you were a school teacher in the village. I am a former English teacher now at the district office of my school district, and Jukebox is actually a high school English teacher. So
All right. Well, don't check, my spelling ain't great, but it's good to be amongst teachers, man. Right on. Good
work. Nice. Now, you said you've been training for the show for a while. When did you first become aware of the show? Do you remember that moment? Because I remember the moment where I was flipping through the channels and I saw this insane show that just hooked me in instantly. Do you remember when you had that moment, or did you have a moment like that where you said, oh my gosh, what is going on here? And I need to be on that show.
So it was October 2019, and my parents came up to visit to the island. I was living on this island. I was alone on the island. It was fall. And so, you know, I worked for a field school. So we have students out there 5 months a year, but the other 7 months I'm pretty much alone. So they came up and stayed with me for a month in October. And it was like, I don't know, 2 weeks into their trip, mid-October, and my mom said, you have got to watch this show alone. Like, I think you're going to love it. And so, little did I know, they'd already had 6 seasons out. So we turned on an episode, and my jaw just dropped, and I was like, hold on. So you're telling me you can go, if you camp the longest, you can win $500,000? And I knew right then. I said, I've got to try this. So the whole time we watched episodes together, I was, you know, playing the backseat survivalist, like, oh, I'd do this, or I'd have done that, or what were they thinking, or blah, you know, the whole thing. And so I got pretty excited, but then I forgot about it. And so that was October, watched the show, loved it, and thought, man, I'd like to do that. And then I was traveling to Thailand in February 2020, right before the pandemic. And I was overnighting in Seoul, South Korea, in the airport, and just sleeping in the airport. There was like 7 people in the airport. I think the pandemic had already kind of, you know, caused some anxiety and some stuff there. So anyway, I'm sleeping in the airport and I thought, oh my God, that show Alone. I was like, I should reach out. So I sent them a little email on my phone with a couple pictures and yeah, and the rest is history. I can tell you more about the process, but that's kind of how it went for me. So I heard about the show October of 2019 and I was on the show October 2020. So I remember being out there in the woods and going, oh my God, a year ago today, I watched my first episode of Alone.
That is a wild story. That's fantastic. And Jukebox, I want to point out something. He mentioned that when he was watching those first episodes while he was living on the island, that he played the armchair survivalist and he had the credentials to back that up, as opposed to you and I, who, you know, all we know is what we've seen on TV and we right. say, oh, you know, why didn't he do this? Or why didn't they think of this? But, you know, he's got the credibility. He's got the street cred there to be an armchair survivalist.
Right. I know. I know. I'm so glad we had Biko and Jordan on earlier this season and we're able to have Coulter on. I think not that it brings more legitimacy to us, but that we gain a better sense of what's actually going on and we can have a more educated opinion and not just spew, you know, hot garbage about the show or what we think they're doing. So I really do appreciate this.
Coulter, you mentioned the application process and sending them a message. Why don't you take us through? I mean, what does it take for somebody to get onto a loan? What is the application process like?
Yeah, so I'm not sure what it looks like for everyone, but I'll share my experience. So I sent that email in February and didn't, you know, then I went on my vacation for the month of March and I came back to the island and in April, I mean, just out of the blue, I got an email. I said, hey, we'd like to talk with you further. You know, and so then I did an interview. I answered some questions, you know, then they asked me to send some video footage. They sent me a GoPro and wanted 10 hours of footage. And then you do more interviews with producers and, you know, you keep going through this interviews, videos, phone calls, stuff like that. And then they say, okay, about June, they said, okay, you made it to boot camp. So we narrowed it down to 20, I think 24, and then they're going to select 12, 10 on the show and two alternates. And so, okay, I go, wow, I'm in the top 24. That's pretty cool. And I'm going to meet, you know, the whole reason I went on here was for the social aspect. So I was like, cool, I'm going to meet 23 other people. And so so I go to the boot camp. Well, typically they fly you to the boot camp and then they do a day of like, you know, a day of fire making, a day of food processing, maybe butchering an animal, maybe a day of filtering water, shelter building and stuff. But this time with COVID, they did it all virtual. So I know that was kind of awkward, both for them and for us a little bit, but I thought they did a really great job. They set up these rooms that you could go in and you had discussions with survivalists and you talked to like a psychologist and you talked to producers and, you know, you kind of went through, answered a bunch of questions. They gave you a bunch of scenarios. We did like bow drill fires and different skills. So we had to make a bow drill fire in 20 minutes at boot camp. That was pretty cool. And then, yeah. Okay. So that's like June or July. And then it's like August 1st, I get a call on the dock. I'm standing on the dock, which is one of the only places I get cell service on the island. And I'm standing there and my phone rings and it was someone that said, hey, this is so-and-so from Alone. I just want to let you know that you're on the show and you leave in 3 weeks. And I was like, so it was a long process, but there was big gaps of silence, radio silence, I felt like. So that was pretty exciting to get that phone call and, you know, you had 3 weeks to figure it out.
Now, Coulter, you said you were excited and you got the call that you were one of the top 24 because you get to meet 23 other people. That's like going into the city for you, right? I mean, if you're on an island, it's just one of you. And now you get to be with 23 other people. I mean, that's crowded living right there.
Oh, that's huge. That's exactly like they ask you many times. They said, Coulter, you live alone on an island. Like, why do you want to go on the show? And I said, I'm going on there for the social aspect. And they laughed. But it's been proven right over and over again. I'm talking with you guys right now. I'm on the show. I've met so many different viewers and survivalists and the production team. And I've met hundreds of people because of this experience. And so some of the value to this experience has definitely been the connections I've made with people. So I love it.
That's great. That's awesome. So you get the call, you're going on the show, right? You got 3 weeks to prepare. They give you a 40 item list of things that you can bring, correct?
Yes.
And how, what is your selection process for these items? Sort of how Doc asked you, hey, what's your one thing you must take? I'm assuming the chainsaw was not on the list of items to bring, correct?
It was not.
Okay. So what are the 10 items that you brought, and how did that decision present itself? How'd you make those decisions?
So I didn't feel like it was too tough. I mean, you know, you can look at, there's been people that have cross-referenced all the seasons and put it into a matrix, you know, of what everyone selected. So you could see what everyone's selecting. I think there's a lot, there's probably 6 or 7 items that everybody takes. Sleeping bag, a pot, you know, either an axe or a saw or both. So like, anyhow, I don't think there's a ton of diversity. You see some things this season, we saw a water bottle and, you know, and I brought a tarp and you see some odd ducks, but mostly it's pretty streamlined. But for me, it wasn't, I narrowed it down to 12 really quick. I knew within 24 hours of getting that list, the 12 items I was taking. So I when I went to the camp, you take all 12 items. So when you go to orientation, so we had to quarantine for 2 weeks, then do orientation camp. So we were together almost a month, the group. So we got pretty close, which was neat. But anyhow, I take my 12 items, and I don't know if you want me to list what they are, but
yeah, sure. Let's hear them. Yeah. And you were the Biko and Jordan did not correct us. I think we said 10 items, but you actually get to bring 12 items.
No, I took 12 items to the orientation camp, and then you only get to take 10 in.
Okay. All right. Okay. Gotcha.
Total that I even wanted. So I just had them all. Some people showed up with 15. Some people showed up with more. Some people only brought 10. They just had their 10 decided, but I showed up. My number 11 was a saw. So the saw wasn't on the list. And my number 12 was a tarp. Well, when we got there to orientation camp, they said, you can't use gill nets till day 45. So gill net was in my top 10. And so then I said, I'm not going to take a gill net and have it be useless for 45 days. So I took the gill net out, replaced it with a saw. And then I said, God, you know, I suck with a ferro rod just as bad as I suck with a bow drill. I said, why don't I just go with a bow drill because it doesn't count against me. So then I said ferro rods out, and number 12 was a tarp so I could build a boat. So that's how I ended up with my 10 items. So the two things that didn't go were the gill net and the ferro rod. I ended up making 2 gill nets, and then a bow drill just ended up working just fine.
Yeah, I think there was an audible gasp in my household, and it was me, actually. I was the only one watching at this time. When I found out that Coulter did not bring a ferro rod, I said, oh, how is this going to play out? I mean, that is a bold decision. But the way you phrase it, you're equally as bad as using a ferro rod as you are a bow drill. It kind of makes sense.
Yeah. And then I've learned, you know, later learned that I'm maybe not quite as bad with a ferro rod. I mean, it's all about your tinder, you know? So like, I don't know. But one of my goals, to be honest with you, like, I've lived in Alaska for 15 years. I consider myself, you know, an outdoorsman, and I've always been pretty self-conscious about how poor my fire making ability is. I mean, I'm not great. And so I was like, I'm going to use this show. If I get anything out of this show, and I'm going to get a lot, but I was like, I'm going to get better at making fires. And man, I improved so much in that 67 days.
Now, I know that you only started watching it the year before, but were you able to get more than one season under your belt of viewing before you started your season?
Yeah, I think I'd watched all of the episodes. I'm not positive on that, but I've watched the greater majority of them for sure. So if not all of them, I watched a lot. I just started binging it. I mean, I was alone on an island that winter. So it was like, it'd get dark, and then we get 6 hours of daylight. So it'd get dark, you know, dark at 4 in the afternoon. So yeah, I'd pop on some episodes at night. It was great.
Netflix starts at 4 up in Alaska.
Oh God, don't quote me on that.
And so, but watching the previous episodes, how did that shape your strategy going into your season? I mean, what was your approach to being successful out there? What was your game plan?
Well, okay. So yeah, you learn a lot. I mean, you learn a lot from the other contestants. You see shelters, you know, things that work, hunting and fishing, trapping systems that work, food and water, and just cool little ideas that they have built in boats or whatever they're building. You know, I mean, you definitely get a lot of intel from the episodes. But then, you know, I also had, you know, kind of my instinct and experience from my life. But then the other thing is, and I don't want to say this like, I'm 100% responsible for my shortcomings. There was no, it was not the location is why I starved. It was not my little square and spot why I starved. Like, it was my own damn fault. So I want to say that, but a lot of what I wanted to do going in strategy was passive hunting and fishing. So it's a lot of like snaring and a lot of trot lines, like set lines, a lot of, you know, your gill net, your trot lines, your like, what, you know, a long line on the bottom, you got your snares out. And so passive gathering, like I know that hiking around takes a ton of calories and in hunting, you know, you're unsuccessful more often than you're successful. So that was my plan. Well, then we bumped up against some regulations. One, can't use a gill net for 45 days. Can't catch any salmon. Can't use barbed hooks. Can't use bait. Can only set one trot line at a time, or one set line. And so, God, a lot of those passive systems, you can't use like a gill net, even a snare grouse, like to use it in you know, where grouse pads are, just little things like that. Like you could have some stuff out. And so that made a lot of it need to be active. So that means you're active hunting and fishing. The only thing we could snare were rabbits, period. And the snow really we never got a good snow. So anyhow, my passive systems kind of got thrown out the window a little bit. So I had to adjust just like everybody else did.
Now, yeah. I know you said that your shortcomings are your own, but those regulations and qualifications that you just listed, not being able to do what you want to do with fishing, only being able to snare rabbits. And I will also throw in there the environment that you were put in at Chilco Lake, which I have as my background for tonight's show. That combines to be one of the toughest environments, one of the toughest set of conditions for a lone contestants to be in, I think, Jukebox. I mean, we've watched all the seasons, and this seemed to be the most difficult location ever. And so I understand that you take responsibility for your shortfalls, but you were put up, you know, behind the eight ball from the very get-go on this.
It was challenging for sure. I mean, it was definitely challenging. You couldn't have any deadfall traps. You couldn't kill mice. You couldn't kill squirrels. Couldn't kill black bear. Couldn't kill brown bear. Couldn't kill moose. Couldn't kill does. Couldn't kill salmon. Couldn't eat salmon if they washed up on the beach. Like, definitely the odds, you know, it made it challenging. You're playing the game in tough mode, but as Clay showed us, like, you could survive out there. And I think he's one hell of an outdoorsman. I think he's an even better guy. And so I think he showed us that, you know, we had to get creative. We had to adapt. You had to, reach deep and connect. And man, I hunted hard. They didn't show that, but I definitely got after some deer hunting and some trapping, which my story became my boat. But yeah, I just couldn't find any animals, land animals.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's interesting you bring up how much you were hunting and trapping, because you're correct. What we saw, I mean, the story of this season was the boat. Your story was the boat. In one of our episodes, I said that you're Captain Coulter, captain of the ship. You had your boat. That's what we saw for a large majority of it. And I was thoroughly impressed with the boat and thought, oh, this is, you know, that next level thinking or strategy or creation construction that's really going to enable you to go a long ways. How did you feel? Was the boat worth it in your opinion?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like saying, I'll come back to that, but it's kind of like saying was taking a bow and arrows worth it. I never shot any one time, but you look and see what big game has done. Season 6, 7, and 8, it's won it, you know, muskox, right, or moose here. And so, the boat, like, I kind of thought the same thing. Like, I looked in the end and said, God, like, it didn't produce like I'd hoped it would. It didn't produce like it probably would have on saltwater or in a different terrain, not being at a high elevation mountain freshwater lake that's pretty sterile. But it helped me stay out there longer. I think it was worth it. I think it was good for morale. I think it was good for calories. Instead of packing, I mean, moving, you know, mass on water is much more efficient than on land. And so, you know, I could move around easier. You know, pretty simple construction, easy use. I thought, you know, fish was where it was going to be, but yeah, just didn't connect like I'd hoped it would. But, you know, I gave the Alone Show about 1,000 hours of footage, okay, in my 67 days, and it gets boiled down to about 45 minutes of airtime. So I understand that my story was my boat, and I don't have any resentment over what they chose to show or didn't chose to shoot or show. But yeah, I did hunt. I hunted like 12 days in a row till dark at the end of October. I hunted, every day I was hunting, looking for grouse, deer, rabbits with my bow, carrying my bow around. I was setting snares and checking snares, and they didn't show it, but that's all right. Like you gotta get everyone's story in a real short amount of time. I'd love to see that 999 hours of footage that no one's seen though. Kind of fun.
So would I.
Yeah, how do we get our hands on that?
I don't know. If you figure it out, tell me. I can't even see it. I can't access it, but dang, I'd love to.
Hey, we have a running debate here on Solitude about what is tougher out there, the starvation or the loneliness? And I'm interested to hear what your perspective might be on that, Coulter.
Yeah, starvation, 100%. I mean, for me, okay, everyone else, like, here's the deal, loneliness. First off, 67 days wasn't even in probably my top 10 camping trips I've been on. Like, I've been on longer trips. And I'm not, like, an outdoor junkie. Like, I'm not a adrenaline junkie or anything like that. Like, I don't go, you know, for years. But I'm saying it's like I've been on 60, 70, 80, 90-day camping trips before. So that helped prepare me that I knew kind of what I was getting into. And then living on an island alone or living in the bush in Alaska, like, and being pretty remote and not having a lot of contact, like, that helped me. And then also being single, not having kids and a family and a partner, a spouse. So, like, I had all this, you know, training and circumstance that helped me, like, isolation, like, loneliness. I can honestly say I didn't feel alone one time out there, like, or lonely or isolated, not once. And because it was just temporary and it's pretty short term, you know, it's going to go 2, 3, 4 months tops. It's like, yeah, it's nothing. So, but the starvation is something that I don't think anybody has experience with, thankfully, is real starvation. Like, you know, when you go camping, you want to take, you know, your granola bars and trail mix and Snickers bars and, you know, whatever you can. And it just tastes so good around a fire when you're out there. And like, to go out there and on day one, like, you reach in your pocket to get your snacks and you got nothing. And day two, you got nothing. And you're like, oh my God, like your whole view of what you need to do shifts and said, oh my God, every day when I wake up, it's literally get calories and that's it. 100% for your focus. So yeah, starvation hands down.
At Jukebox, you were talking about next level strategies and training and ideas. I think maybe the next level training for alone is not to, you know, work on your ferro rod skills or your bow skills, but maybe it's to just not eat for, you know, 30, 40 days and not talk to anybody, not have any human interaction for a month and a half. And that'll prepare you to be successful in alone.
I mean, we talk about it and we talked about it more this season in terms of the gamesmanship that goes on with contestants thinking about other contestants out there and sort of the evolution of the game of alone. And I only think it's a matter of time before we start to have contestants that are really trying to science the starvation out there and find ways to really prepare their body ahead of time to, you know, put themselves at a biological advantage when it comes to dealing with the hunger. I mean, I think I can't doctor that up for you. I'm not familiar with how to do this, but I'm sure someone who's dedicated to winning might think about that before, maybe in a couple seasons or so.
I think you're right. I got a friend, James McDougal. If he's listening, he'll science the shit out of that. You're right. I love that kind of next level, like what people are going to start doing to prep for this, because I think there's a lot you can do with metabolism and fasting and some different things. I didn't do it, you know, and then also the fat that you bring with you, they call your 11th item. So, you know, Biko had a bigger 11th item than most. But you know, there are strategies that you kind of have people in the hibernation camp and the calorie efficiency camp, and you have people that are balls to the wall hunting, fishing, trapping, trying to get all the calories they can. So, and people shift. I kind of shifted throughout. I went into hibernation mode later in the game thinking, oh, that's what I need to sleep. You know, I need to sleep more or stay put in my shelter more. But I kind of got antsy and said, oh, hell with this. I want to go out swinging. So that's what I did.
I love it.
Fantastic. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Coulter about some of the events that have transpired on the show and get his perspective as it was happening, what was going through his mind and what his impressions were as we were at home in the safety of our homes, watching him go through this stuff. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back. Hi guys, it's Doc from the John Freaking Muir Pod. Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. First of all, it's free. There are creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. And Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can also make money for your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast all in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Welcome back to both the Solitude podcast and also the John Freaking Muir Pod. We are talking with Coulter from season 8 of Alone. And he's already been a fantastic guest, and I cannot wait until we talk about some of these items in front of us here. So Jukebox, get us started here.
Yeah, so Coulter, obviously the show, out of your 1,000 hours of footage and all of your fellow contestants, they place an emphasis, I think, on making sure they get the videos of the craziest things you all eat out there. So what were some of the craziest things you consumed during your tenure on Alone, and maybe what tasted the worst and what tasted the best out of those crazy things?
Well, it's not a very long list, because as you can see, I didn't eat a whole lot. But I'll tell you a couple of things I ate were the one that I got on film and they showed was that wormy woodpecker. So I went fishing one day, and I got right down to the water. I was fishing from shores, maybe day 40. I don't know what it was, 45. And all of a sudden, I just look up, I'm casting, going down the beach, and I look up, and there's a bird floating there. And so I get a long stick and bring it to the shore, and it's a woodpecker. And I'm like, and it looked pretty good. It wasn't that rigid, so it didn't look like it'd been dead very long. Open it up, and it's just packed with worms. And so I just made sure to boil the hell out of it, but it tasted fantastic. It was like the best food I'd tasted in, well, 40 some odd days, however long I'd been out there. It was so good to have red meat and eat the heart and the gizzard and the liver and the, you know, and everything. That was really good. But, you know, I don't know. I'm not, you know, not in the market for many woodpeckers, especially not wormy ones nowadays. And the other thing that they didn't show, and it was really my own fault because I didn't film it that well, but was maggots. So I started, I was a maggot farmer out there. I dug a hole and put all my fish guts in a hole because we couldn't use them for bait. So I only had the maggots for about 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. And I was trying to fatten them up and get quite a bit larger. Then somewhere in early October there, we got a snow and it wiped them out. But that was, I was hoping to throw in about 20 of those with every day with my tea or my soup or whatever, dried mushrooms, whatever I was eating. I was going to, you know, try and have 25 to 50 maggots a day. And so that's probably the two weirdest things I ate while I was out there.
Two words that when I woke up this morning, I did not expect to be put together in the same phrase. And that is maggot farmer.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm proud of that. That was, I wish I'd have got better footage of it. And I thought they were going to be around for a while. So I was like, oh yeah, I was going to play this up and have my little maggot farm. When the bears, you know, hibernated, I was going to move that farm inside my shelter. And I was pretty stoked about it. And that snow came and they were gone. And God, I couldn't believe it. I dug around in that hole through all the guts and I couldn't find one. And I was so sad. But so I only filmed them, I think, once or twice in it, and just never had a real storyline to it. So I see why they didn't put it in.
I can't tell you how hopeful I am that a future contestant of the show Alone hears your story of trying to farm maggots and does that successfully on the show, because I really would love to see that in action on Alone. I think that's next level. I think that's advanced thinking for the show, for sure.
Well, I didn't expect those words to go together either. Maggot farmer and advanced thinking. Sorry.
Nice. Hey, one of the challenges of this location, Chilco Lake, was the fact that there were 200 plus grizzly bears roaming the perimeter. And so, you know, talk to us about that. Talk to us about the pressure of having that number of grizzlies roaming around. And did you have any grizzly encounters?
Yeah, I didn't have a whole lot of grizzly encounters. You know, I had the one that you saw on day, I think I saw two bears the whole time I was out there. And that one on day 15 was the closest by far. But I'm pretty fortunate. Again, I'm not, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm, grizzly bears aren't going to do anything to me. Like, no, grizzly bears are incredibly powerful and incredible predators as well. But I've had so many interactions with brown bears since being in Alaska, hundreds of interactions, fishing and hunting and sitting in tree stands or processing salmon on the beach or in boats or rafts. So like, they're fairly, like most wild animals, they don't want anything to do with you. And even though they could, they're this huge predator, that they could do something. And then every once in a while do, you know, when there's a cubs, mom and cubs, or if you surprise one, or if you're on, it's on a kill, like there are circumstances that make them pretty unpredictable or dangerous. But no, like I didn't feel threatened. I didn't feel worried or scared. You definitely have your hair stands up on your neck a little bit being in grizzly country. Like, you know, you're not the biggest, you know, predator in the country there, but they're not out. They've been coming to that land for hundreds or thousands of tens of thousands of years for salmon or for other resources. So they're really tuned into that. And so we like to make it about us and we like to really play up the drama and they're hunting us and they're looking for us every second. You know, we're on the land, we're being hunted by the bears. Like, no, not, that's not really the case. I think that, that makes good TV, but no, they're doing their thing. We want to stay away from each other.
That's a good perspective. That's I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think you're exactly right. Yep. Good perspective there.
Yeah.
They're beautiful creatures and definitely define wilderness. To feed a bear, the amount of calories that bear has to eat in a day, you got to have a really healthy ecosystem because, and so fish and birds and fry, and I mean the whole thing throughout because they got to consume an enormous amount of food. And so you're definitely in competition. They're out there fishing and looking for, you know, fawns and different things that they might be hunting, roots and berries. So like you're in competition with them. You kind of feel that, but it's also means you're in a pretty wild place if you're there sharing it with grizzly bears.
Yeah. And speaking of these grizzly bears, I'm just thinking about all of the phrases we hear on the show and one-liners and zingers from the contestants. And I'm wondering how long it is before the History Channel decides that they're going to start to sell merchandise for this show, like T-shirts or stickers with these phrases, because I would really enjoy a Hey Bear shirt. That would be something I would consider buying, and I'm sure the History Channel is going to take my money at this point. But I would really appreciate that if they would maybe think about it.
So that's a hard question for me because I think they do very well. I think whoever made shirts with Rock House or Hey Bear or all the other one-liners we've seen throughout the years, I think they'd sell well. I'm of the mindset as probably a lot of people. I don't know, in this survival or outdoor world, that we don't need more stuff, consumer goods. It's the last thing our planet needs right now is more T-shirts. But people that are looking to make a buck, I think, could do pretty dang well. And it'd be fun. I think it'd be super fun to see them around town, you know, the shirts. So I don't want to be a buzzkill.
Right.
But I'd probably buy one, but we sure as hell don't need more stuff.
Understandable. All right, Doc, did you want to take us into our next moment out there or our next event?
Yeah, you know, we've seen other contestants talk about this and we kind of glean it from their conversations with themselves out there about they feel the pressure of knowing that people are watching them on TV, that this is going to be played back for a national, international audience, and they feel the pressure of those eyes on them. Did you have that kind of experience out there? Do you feel like people were going to watch you and judge your actions?
No, I didn't feel too much about the judgment. I think people are generally really good and nice and loving and like kind hearted. So like, and I generally, I mean, I trust people and I've had nothing but in 37 years, my experience, people have been very, I don't know, warm and welcoming. And so, of course, there's trolls and all these people on websites that are get after you about this or that. And like, I don't know, that's not a big deal. I think there'll always be that. But yeah, I think the awkwardness for me, it was like in the beginning, the awkwardness of looking into a camera and like, you know, trying to look natural, but sound excited, but like do film something and cover something you're doing really well and artistically and make it, you know, like, so that was more, for me, it wasn't about what the people thought of it. Is my, or I would have washed my face. It was more about like, it was more like trying to make good TV and good coverage. And like, I mean, to be honest with you, Biko and Matt and Teresa, I feel like make really good TV. A lot of them did, but like, they're fun and they tell jokes and sing songs and do accents. Like, that's not me. And so like, to be myself, like, it's a lot of quiet time sitting around camp, sitting around a fire. You know, I tied 1300 knots for my gill net. And the only thing I could do was count, you know, 477. And I just kept apologizing to the camera going, this is the most boring shit I could possibly be saying. I'm sorry. But yeah, so for me, and then it got more natural. So after maybe day 10 or whatever it was like, I just was totally myself and my voice and what I was filming and my sense of humor and everything, like that awkwardness of the cameras and speaking into it and like trying to frame your face and all stuff kind of disappears. And I'd say the last 50 days, you just kind of do your thing and you get frustrated, you know, like when the batteries die on the cameras, you got to reshoot something, or when the SD card's full, or, you know, I mean, there's the filming is a lot of work. But definitely people's judgment and view of people watching it didn't cause me to lose any sleep. I think people are great. People have been very supportive and it's a fun community of people.
Yeah. Two things about what you just said, Coulter. First thing, it's refreshing to hear somebody who lives alone on an island and who's never lived in a town with, you know, more than, a couple hundred people that you still reference internet trolls. I thought that was awesome. And then the second thing, you talk about, you know, making good TV and other contestants, how you think they're good TV and how, you know, you kind of struggled or at least thought you struggled to make good TV. And for me as a viewer, I think one reason that I was so attached to your journey and pulling for you so hard is because I think that you really showed that you were a competitor out there, like a contestant, of course, but your competitiveness and ability to just say, hey, I'm not giving up out here, because there were times when I think a lot of viewers might've thought you were down on an episode or like, as we like to put it, maybe driving the struggle bus for a week or two on the show. But I think that one reason I was drawn to you and your journey was because of your competitive edge and just, you know, your willpower.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, I definitely didn't plan on giving up and never felt, you know, I wasn't so cold or wasn't lonely. Even though my body was starving, I didn't feel like hunger pains or any of that. Like, I was going to keep going. And I told them early on and meant it, like, I'm going to stay out here until they tell me I can't anymore. And whether that's because I won or for medical reasons, like, I'm just going to do that because I love it. I love my routine and I love the life out there and love the lifestyle. So, like, it was, I mean, I had such a great time on that show. I would have loved to have gotten more food, but overall, like my daily routine, I loved every second of it. So
that's amazing. So Doc, it looks like I'm just looking at our agenda here. It looks like we've covered a couple of these already. So I'm gonna kind of jump around here.
I think
one thing that a lot of viewers would be interested to hear about is when you first created the boat or were maybe in the process of creating the boat, you dropped your knife onto the tarp twice. What was going through your head when that knife fell out of your hand?
And before you answer, Coulter, yeah, you know, the two armchair survivalists here, we're watching the show trying to glean any kind of hint or sense of, you know, where the show is going and how the contestants are going to fare. And I have to tell you that this was a topic of conversation on the show when we saw you drop the knife, not once, but twice, knife point down into the tarp as you're making a boat. I'm thinking, this does not bode well for Coulter. I don't know how long he's going to go out there, but take us through that.
Yeah, I just classic Barnes move right there. It's like, Dad, you're going to hate this story, but I'll make it quick. But one time we were going into our elk hunting spot, we were driving into this lookout, and then you hike kind of around this mountain, and anyhow, it was dark, and a herd of elk ran across, and they're right there. So we pull off the road and we're just going to wait till daylight and then try and sneak on them or, you know, make a hike after, see where they went. And he hits the car alarm button and the car alarm starts going off and scares everything out of the country for miles, you know. So classic move was the dropping of the Leatherman. And I swear to God, that first time it dropped, it stuck in the tarp with like you try to stick a knife in the ground or in the piece of wood. Like, I was just like, oh my God, this whole strategy, this whole boat thing. And I'm just about on the last step to get the skin on and I drop in my knife. So it was funny. Like, I like that stuff and the humor. Like, it's not going to be the end of the game. A bear's chews on that thing, it's not going to be as funny. But dropping a little knife in there, like, then I'll have to make some, you know, pitch glue and seal it up or melt it or, you know, come up with a way to salvage it. And then that's just an adventure in itself. But I think the word adventure, I heard this quote one time, that the word adventure gets overused and adventure is when everything goes wrong. And so when I dropped that knife into that tarp, that is when the adventure starts. So, but I just laugh. I just think it's funny, like just a dummy move, but it's not going to take me out of the game. Just make it more challenging.
Fantastic. Another one of our favorite moments was when you opened up the episode by saying that you took a dump in the living room and you were just so excited and satisfied by that. And you know, we were living vicariously through you. And, you know, we wondered, you know, did you dig a hole in the living room and did you bury it afterwards? Did it freeze? And you kind of just chucked it out after, you know, how did that all work?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. I love poop and I love composting it and I love talking about it. And I love a lot of, I think our world's quite fecal phobic, you know, so I get any chance I can get to talk about it, it's a good one. But I actually was using a flat rock. I think I did it a couple times. I think I did it twice, but I had a flat rock that I would use. I had a bunch of them that I'd use to move my fires around. So I'd haul coals and around to new fire pits. And so I just went on one of those one time. I think the urge hit me quick, or it was super cold and snowing outside, or it was dark, or for some reason I didn't want to go outside. And then it was like so pleasurable. It was warm. I didn't have to take off like 15 layers. I didn't have to go anywhere. And then when I went to my log that I had designated a hole where I usually would go to the bathroom, I just took the rock over there and chucked it in. So I was like, dang, like this is something, man. Like that was really nice. Like I gotta do that again. So. Yeah, I'm glad that the History Channel decided to put that footage in there.
You know, Jukebox, I'm going to tell your mom, I'm going to take the same strategy. I'm going to class it up a little bit. I won't put rocks in the living room, but maybe a plate or something, you know. And so I just take it over to the bathroom later.
Yeah, if that happens, we won't be hearing from you for a while.
Well, it's quite enjoyable. Don't knock it until you try it.
No, I won't. I don't...
But Jukebox and I have done quite a bit of through hiking, and so we understand the joys of having some of the best sights while you're sitting on the throne out there. So
yeah, no, I love the quote. Something's like nothing's more overrated than an orgasm, or more underrated than a good bowel movement.
I wish we had heard. I don't know if the History Channel would have included that, but that would have been a great one-liner for the viewers.
I'm gonna order my hat tonight.
All right. So, of course, we have taken a dump in the living room. We talked about dropping the knife. We got your opinion on the active and passive hunting and foraging. How about you losing 86 pounds? So on the show, you lost 86 pounds. You've already talked to us about the hunger. What was that sort of recovery like for you after the show? Like how did that weight get put back on? Because it looks like you're in better shape right now, a better condition than the minus 86 pounds at the end of your tenure. But sort of what type of physical toll did that really take on you in terms of recovery?
Yeah, well, it's been interesting. Okay, it's the emotional toll wasn't much. Like I feel that didn't have much of an effect on starvation, thankfully. But physically, I actually felt better, I think, at 156 pounds than I do at 256. I've put on 100 pounds this year since I came off the show, and It's a really quick 100 pounds. So it just wasn't done very healthily. I feel like I wasn't working out or doing, you know, lots of exercise and physical movement. And so, you know, a lot of my like limberness and flexibility and like, it's just not there. And so while people look at me and say, wow, you look just like the Coulter of old, or you look back to normal, I definitely don't feel like it, you know? So I need to do some hard work, and I need to, and it's going to take time. It just doesn't happen quick. So I need to get back into a healthy lifestyle. I've definitely been eating a lot more, but I'll talk a little bit about that. That 13 days, what they call a refeeding program, that as after the show, I was there for 13 days because I'd lost so much food, and they just do a really great job of making sure they have like a medic checking on you and doing vitals and weight and checking your ankles and your feet for swelling and just all this stuff. And so every day, and then you talk with a nutritionist, and the doctor would come in and check on you at night, and like, so you had this really wonderful team, you know, taking very seriously your physical health after the show. So much appreciated. But I ate a lot of broth those first few days, tons of avocados, yogurt, vitamins, stuff like that, but yams. But in that 13 days, I'd gained 50 pounds.
Wow.
And so they said a lot of that is retaining water. So like from when they pump you full of vitamins, you're going to hold a lot more water than you could before. So a lot of that's water weight, but they were worried I was gaining too much weight too fast. And so, so then I've gained 50 pounds of those 13 days. I've gained 50 pounds since. So I'm up here. But what I noticed is a lasting lingering effect is your brain. I misquoted this one time. Your brain uses 20% of the calories that you put in your body. And so when you're starving and you've went through all of your fat reserves, you're starting to go into your muscle bank, like I think your brain's taking quite a hit. You know, there was 3 weeks there I didn't eat hardly any food, no protein. I just ate plant food, you know, mushrooms and rose hips and onions and stuff like that, but not many calories and definitely not any fat and protein. So I feel it. I've had a lot of mental errors in the last 6 months, a lot of just stupid mistakes that I didn't make before. And so I probably had more mental errors in the last 6 months than I had in the last 30 years. And so that's been kind of noticeable. Now I think the brain's going to recover. I think having conversations, me getting back into civilization, reading, you know, brain plasticity is pretty, pretty neat. And so I know I'm going to be fine. But that's where I feel it today. The number one thing that I feel physically from the starvation or from the show experience is just kind of dull up here, man, duller than normal.
Got it. Yeah. I don't know what my excuse is, but it certainly wasn't losing 86 pounds. Coulter, as we were watching the show, I know that you had no idea how many contestants were left, but it got down to the final four. And Jukebox and I were saying, you know what? Any one of these four could win it. Any one of these four has a shot. And you were bound and determined that you were not going to tap out. You were not going to push the button. They're going to have to drag you out. And sure enough, that's what happened. They came out and did a medical evaluation, determined that you had lost too much weight, and they pulled you for safety reasons. Take us through that whole experience and you know, how that impacted you, what you were thinking and feeling when they gave you that news.
Yeah, it was pretty devastating. It was so when they told me that, you know, I also kind of felt that it might be coming, you know, like I obviously could tell my body was getting weak and fatigued quite easy. I'd lost a bunch of weight, you know, to kind of warn me at other med checks. So but it's a huge weight lifted off your shoulders, as well as like that burden of survival. So there's that, but it doesn't feel good. It's like, you feel like you've kind of failed, and you feel like at that moment you just would have done everything. You would have done so much differently, or, oh my God, I should have went harder. I should have pushed harder in this, and I should have pushed harder in that one. So just like, it was a lot going through my head, but I just felt pretty devastated that you get one chance at your kind of Olympics of the outdoor world, or the, you know, outdoor survival competition. And to just know that you just didn't feel like you had your best performance. And so that but I don't feel like they shorted me at all. The show gave me every opportunity in the world. I have no resentment. I don't feel like, oh, they should have left me longer. I had more time. Like, nope, I would have stayed out there longer, but it might have been detrimental to my health. And so they let me push my limits. And I feel like I really got to touch my limits, and I've never done that before. So I definitely am grateful I'm grateful that they pulled me. I'm also grateful that they let me go to the bitter end. So.
Yeah, and I have to ask, is there any fourth place money out there from the History Channel? Is it winner take all, or is there money for other finishers?
I don't know. Am I getting paid today to be on here? You tell me. Same answer. No money paid for fourth. What's below bronze?
Yeah, you didn't send a rider agreement to me, so I'm not sure what you're getting paid today.
We'll have to make some t-shirts.
There you go. Hey, do you keep up with any of the contestants from season 8?
Yeah, almost all of them. Yeah, I keep up with all of them. I definitely, definitely Michelle and Biko and Rose and Teresa and Clay. And yeah, all. I mean, I keep chatting online. I went and had, right around Christmas time, I went and met Clay out of his place in Idaho and met his wife and his two sons. Had a dinner and hung out for a few hours. Went and stopped by Biko's place when I was down on the Oregon coast. Definitely want to visit some of the others, but yeah, great people. And, you know, a lot of them are really technical and trained survivalists and outdoorsmen that I have a ton of respect for. I don't have that kind of the book smarts when it comes to, I'm not a survivalist. A lot of my stuff's just kind of like, I don't know, homesteading or a lifestyle or just experiential. And these guys have years, if not decades, of training. So it's pretty cool to pick their brains, and I'd like to take some classes from them for sure.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Just hearing from Biko and Jordan earlier this season and them talking about, yes, we are competing for this money, but a better way to look at us are our contestants, because, you know, we want each other to succeed out there. So it's pretty awesome to hear you talk about, you know, visiting these other contestants and staying in touch and sort of like this companionship that all of you seem to enjoy even after the show.
Yeah. And it really is a competition against yourself, because in my square, no matter what Clay or Biko or Teresa are doing in their squares, it doesn't affect mine. Like, so if I'm catching fish or not catching fish or happy or sad, like that doesn't have any determination on what they're doing. So it's really, I'd love to get dropped off in the same square on the same date and with the same regulations and do better than I did and do better in 67 days. And so it just felt like that was great. I never felt like I was competing against them, and I'm not competing against nature. I think that's another way that you get a quick out. It's like, I'm trying to learn from the environment fast enough to be able to live off of it. And unfortunately I didn't do that.
Not competing against nature. I feel like that's a mentality a lot of contestants need to have, because I'm sure you would confirm this, but if you're competing against nature, you will lose every time.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's a big wall you're staring at, if that's your attitude.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's going to be a hard fall from your pedestal.
Now, we've had a number of seasons. We've had 8 seasons of Alone. And one of the things that Jukebox and I have been kicking around is this concept of, okay, we've had enough seasons now, so we can do Alone All-Stars. I mean, other reality shows, they have All-Stars. If the History Channel picks up on this concept and does an Alone All-Stars season, I think you would definitely qualify. Would you be up for that if they approached you and said, hey, Coulter, I want you to be an All-Star. Come back on the show.
I could literally be out the door in 5 minutes. Literally. I'm not kidding. I'd go in a heartbeat. There'd be no question. I wouldn't think about it for a second. I would leave right now. I'd hang up on whatever podcast I'm talking with, and I would just. So yeah, hell yeah. I want another shot. And again, it's not like, oh, I need that money so bad. Like, I want to do it for that money. Like, no, the experience is phenomenal. You dream about that as a kid, like going out in the middle of nowhere with no tools and hardly anything and like trying to survive. So like the experience is phenomenal, and you learn a lot about yourself, a lot about a neat wild place on the planet. Like, you meet a bunch of people. So like the experience is phenomenal, but like, I just want to push myself. I want to do better. And I would give anything to have another shot at it. I'd go wherever they said, tropics, Antarctica, I don't care. You know, time of year, like I'd go.
But Jukebox, just count ourselves lucky that the phone call didn't come during this podcast.
That's right. That's right. At least earlier in the podcast. If it happened now, it'd be quite the exit. We'd really get the folks going.
It's quite a lead up here.
Walter, what was the reaction of family and friends to your performance on the show? When you came back, what kind of feedback did you get from folks?
Well, are you talking about when I came back from the show, or are you talking about when it aired?
Good point. When the show aired, after the show aired, what kind of response did you get from family and friends?
Yeah, family and friends have been supportive like my whole life, no matter what I do. They've always been very supportive. So yeah, they were proud and supportive, like tons of shout outs and messages and phone calls. And, it was pretty sweet. And to feel that love and support, but I wasn't surprised by it. But you know, like, I know, I think my mom was watching the show with her church group, and they asked, why is it beep so many times when I'm on? So, you know, I told them that was the camera battery was low. But otherwise, you know, why didn't you wash a few things? But otherwise, been pretty supportive, really supportive.
Fantastic. And what's next for Coulter? What's the next big adventure out there for you?
Well, I got some ideas in the works. So I had started a business at one time called Highway Homesteaders. And I was going to travel around the country doing half labor and half education, like do some workshops on canning and brewing and baking and solar power and aquaponics and gardening and construction and stuff like that. But then also do labor to where I put in gardens and chicken coops and solar power panels and stuff like that. And so I'm thinking about reviving that dream. I ended up taking a job for 3 years on this island and put that business aside. And so I kind of want to pick it up, but I need to get a bus and a trailer and a kitchen. I kind of want to travel the country and go to people where they're at. I've always kind of lived in Alaska and worked in schools here where I try and bring people out here to Alaska, to really remote Alaska. Well, not everyone can do that. Not everyone has the budget or the time or the capacity to be able to do that. So I kind of want to go where you guys are and go to St. Louis and Tampa, Florida, and go wherever to where people are, and not necessarily teach DIY skills, but yeah, help learn and grow and share and explore them together. And so that's kind of something that I'm kind of getting momentum for. So that's probably the next big adventure. Right now I'm heading back into the village and planning on reading for the winter. I'm going to read as many books as I can this winter. Chop firewood and read. That's the plan. I need to get my brain, give it a little bit of a workout, and my body.
Nice. What's at the top of your reading list?
Oh man, I got a huge reading list. Top of my reading list is going to be People's History of the United States, Rediscovery of North America, Barry Lopez. Yeah, there's just so much. I'll probably read some Steinbeck and Malcolm Gladwell, and I don't know. That's a good question. It's a big list.
You're talking Jukebox's language right there. Did you see him light up?
I was going to say, Coulter, I'm not sure if you've read this book before, but I recently started a book this week called 1491 by Charles C. Mann. And
I haven't read it.
You haven't? No. So it's basically a book dispelling the popular belief, I guess, you know, decades or generations before, but still kind of penetrating now, of that the natives of North America had no impact on the land, or that they were just sort of, you know, witnesses to everything that happened. And it's kind of, you know, showing how they were really advanced in the way they lived and agriculture and structures they were able to come up with. And you know, being taught one thing growing up and coming to read a book that's kind of blowing your mind. I'm really enjoying it so far. So
right, I'll check it out. I'll have to check it out. Have you read Homo Deus?
I have not.
All right. We'll do a little book swap, a little book club next time. Okay. I appreciate the recommendations. I'm trying to get 3 recommendations from every one of my friends and family and people I meet. And so I presented in a school the other day in Juneau, and the kids were writing recommendations on the board. So I'm trying to put together a pretty comprehensive reading list and get to know people through the books that they think I need to read. So.
Right. Awesome. Right on.
Nice. Hey, Jukebox, you know, I'm a little disappointed because at the beginning of the episode, Coulter shared that, you know, there, if we ask certain questions that were off limits or off topic, that he, you know, he may not be able to answer them because of, you know, his agreement with the History Channel. And he did not give that excuse once. He did not. So we did not ask the right questions, I feel. So right. We're going to wrap up tonight's segment with one more, or tonight's episode with one more segment called What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Me About?
God, what have you not asked me that I'm dying? Well, we've talked about poop, and we've talked about maggot farming, and geez, I can't. That's what I really wanted to share was definitely the maggot farm, but we talked about my next steps. What have you not asked me? This is a tough one, you guys. I should have been prepared for this, but I thought it'd be the maggots. I got nothing.
Okay. That shows this is a comprehensive interview. Nice.
Yeah. I think you guys covered everything and more. And yeah, it's been great. It's been really good to talk with you. I really like that you guys get in, you focus on the show, but you look for a lot deeper as to the whys and the upbringing, and you're looking further down the road of what contestants are going to be doing and making some predictions. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. I'd love to do it again sometime.
You know, if I'm going to take you up on this, Coulter, because if season 9 is not Alone All-Stars, would you mind if we invited you to be the occasional co-host? It'd be the three of us talking about what's happening on season 9 of Alone.
Yeah, I'd come do it. Okay. Be fun. All
right. Fantastic. Fantastic. All right. That is a wrap from the Solitude Studio. And again, I want to thank Coulter for coming on and being our guest this week. You were tremendous on Alone and just as epic on the podcast today. Any shout outs to friends and family, Coulter?
Well, no, I always give a shout out. I'll give a couple here to Tidelines Institute, to my people back on the island. Appreciate all the support during the show. Let me go do that opportunity and the time I got to spend in the last few years. And definitely shout out to my mom and dad for making this all possible. Not just having me and raising me, but also introducing me to the show and sending me on this crazy wild path that I've been on. So, yeah. Love you guys.
Fantastic. Jukebox, any final thoughts or comments?
Just want to thank Coulter for the time tonight and giving us a further glimpse into a show that we appreciate. And just for, you know, living up to what we loved and respected about you on the show. I think this, this was a great experience for me, and I look forward to our future conversations and potential podcasts for season 9.
Awesome. Thanks, you guys. It's been great. Have a good night.
You too. All right. Along with Coulter, Doc, and Jukebox are pushing the button and tapping out for now. Make sure that you guys watch all of the Alone content you can out there. Can't wait to see what season 9 looks like. Jukebox, go ahead and take us out.
We're born alone. We live alone. We die alone.